I think the focus needs to maybe shift from the playlist to the mailing list. And what I mean by that is capturing the fans. There has to be a holistic marketing approach for an artist. And if you're trying to build the career or a story for an artist, it needs to be more than just, you know, one song. And so I think that that's key, where it's just like there has to be a bigger story than just the moment it had on TikTok.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to How Music Charts, where we pull back the curtain on today's music business, exploring music industry trends, music data, and the creativity that helps your favorite artists hit the charts. I'm your co-host, Jason, and you'll hear from our other co-host, Rucker, soon. This podcast is owned and operated by Chartmetric, a music data company that connects numbers to narratives to help the music industry leverage the power of data analytics. On this episode, we chat with Aileen Crowley, former vice president of global streaming marketing at Universal Music Group. Before leaving the major label world in November 2020, Aileen devised data-driven streaming strategy for developing artists, working directly with artist management to translate streaming analytics, develop artist release strategies, and implement plans for audience growth. Prior to that, Aileen was the general manager of Digson, a subscription-based independent music label focused on singles, playlisting, and data, as well as being an artist manager. And that was after spending almost 7 years at world-renowned consulting firm McKinsey & Company. So without further ado, please welcome to the How Music Charts podcast, Aileen Crowley.
Thanks, Jason. I appreciate that.
Of course, of course. Rucker wrote that amazing intro. So cheers to you, Rucker. So Aileen, you're joining us from the Upper West Side of Manhattan today, is that correct?
I sure am.
Cool. All three of us are enjoying a very humid, humid day here in New York City. So it looks like you've been here for a while now in New York, having gone to Columbia University. What are you from here originally? And how did you end up here in the Big Apple?
Yeah, so I'm from right outside of New York City. So this is, I consider this home. I went to school here and spent about 10 years in New York City after college. And then I was for 1 year in Amsterdam, which I loved, and then came back to New York for a little bit and then headed down to Nashville. And then in the last couple of years, was able to return to New York.
Cool. Sociology at Columbia. Tell us why the choice of sociology, and if anything, does that play into what you do today?
I think I just decided to study something I was interested in.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what it came down to. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it's a liberal arts education and it teaches you how to think. And that's kind of what was important at the time. So it's just, and that can kind of translate into any situation. So if this is something where it's like, it's teaching me how to problem solve, teaching me how to think analytically, you know, I can use that across the board in anything I do personally or professionally.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally get it. So after you left your time studying sociology at Columbia, you went to this huge consulting firm, McKinsey & Company. How was your time there? It's such a storied company in the consulting world, in the wider kind of, you know, business world. Can you tell us a little about it as much as you can, you know, you're willing to share about what your time was like there?
Sure. I spent about a half dozen years there, mostly in New York, and it was a great experience. It was, you meet so many incredible people from all over the world with so many different backgrounds, from, you know, a PhD in chemistry to, you know, someone straight out of undergrad that doesn't have any experience at all. But it's a really interesting group of folks and just really super smart people, and just a really great experience, but most importantly, like, just made so many great friends there, and that, you know, continue to be good friends today, and that I've connected with in the last couple of years coming back to New York.
So we're going to get into your entire like music career, which you've done a lot of really cool things, but I really wanted to ask, you know, specifically at that point of that sixth or seventh year at McKinsey, you decided to become an artist manager and leap into the music industry. So up until that point, what was your involvement with music, whether just as a fan or were you doing stuff on the side? Like, what was your life with music at that point?
I was a fan. I would go to, like many people in New York, would go to a show every single night and just enjoy the live experience. And just that was it.
What were you listening to at the time? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh.
What were some of your favorite shows, actually? That's probably a really cool question.
Yeah, I would say like a couple that sort of come to, like spring to mind would be Ray LaMontagne, Phosphorescent. U2 is one of my all-time favorites. Mm. Van Morrison, David Gray. So yeah, those are a few that come to mind, but there's a lot more.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So you're coming up at the end of your time at McKinsey and you decide mm-hmm. you jump into the music industry. What was going through your mind at the time?
I had a dear friend who was a singer-songwriter and she asked me to manage her. And I was weighing sort of what the next step was in my career, in my life. And I said, I'll take a chance and see what, explore this. And so I jumped right in, didn't know what I was doing, but would, you know, gave it a go. And sort of at the same time, I started taking Berklee music online classes so mm-hmm. that I had an idea of like what a copyright was and knew something about like a contract mm-hmm. and knew something, you know, music business 101. Yeah. Just to get a little bit of groundwork there. And so did that, you know, manage her and got, you know, got my feet wet there and loved it. And so I thought that's, you know, that's what I want my career to be. And I want to continue working in music.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a really good, I mean, a very difficult first job to have in the industry, but at the same time, it's kind of all-inclusive to a certain degree. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely.
So after management, you moved on to Digson. Am I pronouncing that right? Digson?
Yep, not Digson. Digson. Yep,
that's right. It stands for digital singles, right?
Yep, that's right.
Is that correct? So can you talk a little bit about that company, like when it was founded and what the sort of business model was of the label?
Yeah, absolutely. So after having a year of management, loving it, knowing I wanted to pursue a career in music, I moved down to Nashville with no job and just saying, you know, let me see what opportunities there are for me here. So I met within the first, you know, month of being in Nashville, I met Jay Frank, who was the founder of Digson. And at the time he was running music strategy at CMT. And so turns out the day I met him was the day he was leaving CMT to start a new venture. And so we met that next day and he told me all about it. So Digson, to answer your question, Rooker, Digson was a digital singles record label. It was a new model record label that really was based on signing artists to short-term artist-friendly deals, 6 songs, a year and a half. And we would release the music to our subscribers for free. Again, this is 2011. So that was a thing then. And so we'd release the music for free, get people's email addresses and have, you know, fans to market all of our releases to. And so that was, and then we'd gather all the data that came back from that and adjust our marketing plans and create the marketing plans accordingly based on the data we were getting back on the music.
So 2011, I'm pretty sure is the year that Spotify came to the US. So could you sort of talk about how the role of streaming and playlisting changed during your years at that label?
Yeah. So you know, in when we first launched our label, it was January 2012 is when we released our first single. And so our focus when we started releasing music the beginning of 2012 was really to build our mailing list and our fan list and really get people into the label, get them into Digsyn, get them to know that anything that we release is going to be quality and it would be branded for the label and you become a fan of any artist that was on the label. So, and that you'd want to subscribe to it because you knew you were going to get all different kinds of music, any genre. We release, you know, from pop music to indie rock. And that was our focus for a long time, growing that subscription to our mailing list. And that also, you know, concurrently with the with Spotify coming into the mix, we were able to also have another source of data, right? So we were able to see, okay, people would download the music here, but then they'd go and stream it on Spotify. They'd stream it on, you know, YouTube actually was a great source for us at the time. So that was actually probably, you know, just looking back and reflecting on it, actually YouTube was probably our best source of data at the time, because we'd release, you know, static video or a lyric video or, you know, an official video. And those were actually places where we were able to see demographics, you know, people were actually listening, thumbs up, thumbs down, you know, all of those metrics were, that's actually primarily what we were using at the time to craft our marketing plans and to craft just our strategy for each artist.
So you also, it sounds like Digsyn had a big focus on digital marketing when it was like coming into its, I don't know, maturity. So you also founded something called Digmark along with Digsyn. Is that right?
Yeah. So Digsyn, you know, we continued, you know, signing artists to the label. Then there were a lot of folks that didn't necessarily want a label deal, right? They were just like, we just need digital marketing help. And we're seeing what you're doing with some of your artists. And can you help us? And so for a while we said, no, we're focusing on Digsyn, signing artists, growing these artists. But then at some point it was just like, you know what? Our whole motto was like, test things out, see if they work, see if they don't. Like that's kind of just the ethos of our company, and continued to be, for years. And so it was just like, you know, let's test this out. Let's take on a client, see what happens. And so we took on our first client and, you know, built all the digital, you know, digital market, anything we could measure, we were measuring and using, you know, reporting back to the client, but also using that to craft strategies. So social media strategy, but what does your website look like? You know, A/B testing images, you know, and using digital advertising to see what, you know, colors work best and what people are clicking on, to, you know, to actually crafting what gets posted on their social media, you know. So it was a holistic approach to digital marketing, for all of our clients, and the clients range from, you know, big country artists to big music festival to music organization. So it kind of was a huge variety of clients.
How much has your thinking about digital marketing and digital strategy changed from that point to today?
I think the underpinning of it all is data. And that was always what was driving our decisions, our strategy from the beginning. And so, and from those early days of getting the data back on what was being downloaded the most, to what artist actually led to more subscriptions. And that hasn't changed. And that sort of continues to be the current running through everything that we've done. And then, you know, and things that I continue to do and questions when people, you know, when someone's just like, well, what do you think about that? And it's just like, it doesn't really matter. It's what the fan thinks. It's what the user thinks. It's if people are reacting to it. So like, let's test it out and see what people like better, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's something where it's just, it's always been at the forefront. You know, data has always been at the forefront of what, of the decisions we're making.
If you're willing to divulge at all, and you can be as sort of specific or general as possible, but can you give some examples of successful data-driven decisions or campaigns that you were part of?
Yeah, I'll give you one that's probably a little bit more recent, working with an artist. And one of the pieces of data that came back on a new release was that she was top, the song was top 100 Shazam in 37 markets, in 37 countries. And that it was top, her top five markets were in Germany and France. I think Paris was maybe her top market. And so taking that data and saying, okay, like one, that's a great story to tell. And if you're not looking at the data and putting all the pieces together and creating a story that's more than just you have X amount of streams, then you're missing an opportunity to be able to tell a compelling story. And then when you say she's top 137 markets, and actually none of those top five markets are in the US, even though she's a US-based artist. So looking at those, you know, those data points and saying, you know, okay, now what's actionable here, right? And so, you know, let's put some, you know, international marketing campaigns together and for Germany and for France. And let's go to those markets and let's make sure that they have what they need to do the marketing locally. And then let's also think about what are the other avenues that we can explore? What does the PR look like in Germany? And, you know, what are some small advertising campaigns that we can do that are super focused to convert some of those listeners and people that are Shazamming it to actual fans, right? And to get those people into, you know, converting the listenership and the, right, the indication of hitting your Shazam to see what the song is and getting them to convert to actual fans and getting the follow and then getting the email to then be able to market back to them and create a lifelong fan and create that long-term engagement. So that's just one example of looking at the data and then actually having some actionable steps to take from it, which is exciting when you can actually do something and from the data that you're seeing.
What are the biggest indicators to you in the data that a listener is becoming a fan?
There's you both know better than anyone all the pieces of data that
there's
you
no
can
way.
Look at. Well, all the pieces of data that you can look at, right, and that are available, and you know, and like what actually constitutes real fandom, right? That's a question we can pontificate on for quite some time. Mm-hmm. If I'm looking at, you know, just a few, you know, a few indicators, it would be saving the song to your collection or your library, right? So whatever that means on whatever platform. It would be visiting that person's website and signing up and taking another, right? Taking the secondary action there where it's just like, I heard the song on a playlist. I added it to my collection because I liked it. Maybe I followed the artist, but then do I take the next step of going and seeking more information out or signing up for something, right? And making that, taking that next step, I think is important. So I guess there's, you know, the initial one would be saving, and then the second one would be just, yeah, doing the next, right, that next step.
Well, I'm gonna go on a little side tangent with you on this. So there's an opinion out there in the industry, and by that I mean just me, that TikTok, it's great for the TikTok's great for the track, but marginally good for the artist. What true, false, somewhere in the middle? How do you view that statement?
I think it's great. It's great for the music, right? It's just, or it can be great for a song. There has to be a holistic marketing approach for an artist. And if you're trying to build the career or a story for an artist, it needs to be more than just, you know, one song. And so I think that's key, where it's just like there has to be a bigger story than just the moment it had on TikTok.
Yeah, cool. Great. Okay, so you move from this to Universal and a lot of years there. So how much of an adjustment did you have to make just personally, just your mindset, between going from the independent label world to the major label world? How did you have to change the way you operated? If at all, maybe you didn't at all. I don't know. But what was that process like for you?
So I'll back up just a little bit, because, you know, we created Digson, you know, we in 2011. We created Digmark probably the following year, which was, you know, our digital marketing arm. And then within, you know, the following like 6 months, we created a streaming promotion company, right? Which that came about, and that's where, right, that's where we really get into playlists in the company, which is having one of our artists have a song added to a playlist. And this is where our independent promotion company came about, because we saw, and back sort of reverse engineering it, the artist, Bronze Radio Return is the artist's name. And we saw, as an independent label, we're looking at the numbers every day. And we saw the streams on this one track double. And then we dug a little bit deeper, double on Spotify. We dug a little deeper, and it was, the streams were coming from Europe. Now the band has never been, again, they're US based, never been to Europe, never toured, you know, we're still growing their audience. We dug a little bit deeper, and then we said, oh, okay, this was added to a playlist. This was added to a playlist that's out of Germany. And when all the listenership is over there. And so we looked at that and thought, okay, this is a user playlist on Spotify. This actually is doing something for the music, for this artist, and growing numbers. So what does this mean? And we kind of said, okay, maybe we can replicate this, right? So if this is, you know, can happen for one of our artists and one of our tracks, one of the songs, that, then why not test it out and see if it can work for others? And so we ended up, you know, at that point, you could, you know, this is 2014, you can message people on Spotify, right? People who had playlists, and, you know, you could look at users' playlists and send them a message saying, I love your playlist, and actually I have the song that fits, you know, great in it. And so we did that, message folks, and to see if it would work. And it did. They added the songs to their playlists. And so we said, okay, like there might, and it had an impact. So we said, maybe there's something to this. And that's where the business and right in, of the promotion company came about, which was, you know what, if playlists are the new radio stations, then, you know, pitching our songs to the playlisters is the new radio promo. And so it's building, you know, it's using all the same, you know, all the same language and everything around radio promotion just for playlisting. And so we started, you know, pitching out our tracks, and then we started all of our digital marketing clients, we started pitching out their tracks to playlisters if it made sense. And then we started taking on, you know, other tracks to pitch out. So that business was created. And that's really where we got into streaming promotion strategy. We worked with some amazing projects in that year, you know, across the world with so many different types of artists. And then our business was then acquired by Universal, and that was about 6 years ago.
Tiffany, okay, Rucker, is that you?
Oh yeah, I heard a beeping.
No, beeping was me.
Okay. Rucker looked behind us like, okay, cool. So what was that process like? That must have been exciting to kind of become a part of this huge label.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like we were working so closely with so many different people mm-hmm. within the label that it just felt like a natural progression, to be honest. And it was just, and it was always just, you know, consistently, you know, innovating and just working with some of the best music in the world, across the world. Mm-hmm. That was really exciting, and being able to, you know, work across markets with so many great people, and actually hearing all the music coming from different countries was also like, that was super interesting as well, because we can, you know, there's so much of the music was coming from the States, but when you had something that really sounded like a hit, or the data was showing, I should say the data was showing it was a hit coming out of Australia or coming out of Japan, those things were really interesting. And to be able to support some of those, you know, those labels that were just a little, you know, little bit has smaller team in certain countries, to be able to support them on a global scale and work to get the track either moved up the charts or to create a story for them to go and tell, you know, to people locally or people in, you know, abroad, to get something going. That was super interesting and super exciting. So.
Okay. It sounds like a huge job overseeing Universal's global playlist network. So streaming and playlist strategy, as you've been talking about, you know, marketing campaigns, charting strategy. How does one take that apart? How do you unpack that a bit? Because it's a lot. It sounds like a lot. How, you know, what was that process like for you, you know, stepping into that, you know, responsibility? And how did that kind of break down, and what did that entail to you from like a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, Jason, we had an amazing team.
Totally. And,
right. I kind of skipped over coming into Universal a little bit, but just like, you know, we had an amazing team that, you know, that was built that we were building for several years. Yes, I was the first employee and worked closely alongside, you know, Jay, our founder. But it was, you know, we had the right people, right? And we had a great crew that were trusted and really amazing at what they did. So I'll start with that. Okay. And, you know, coming in at a time where everyone's just trying to figure out, what do we do here, right? What do we do with streaming? And what does this all mean? It was, you know, from a operational standpoint and what we did every day, right? It was one, going in as a brand new department, right? We were a brand new department. And so global streaming marketing department didn't exist before we came in. And so going in and being able to, you know, just have meetings with all the labels and, you know, all our international partners, and kind of seeing, right, what was the lay of the land? What was there? What existed? And how do we augment everything that so many of these talented people across the world are already doing? And how do we bring that and align it globally so that the power of, you know, having, you know, the major label teams across the world is really all the talented people that are across the world that are and aligning things globally is super important.
Like it sounds like just a huge responsibility to talk about, you know, the playlist network of, you know, the biggest label in the world. And how does one even begin to deal with that? You know, even with a great team, you know, cause you know, at the end of the day, they need to figure out what the big goal is.
Yeah. So at first it was doing the audit of what playlist actually existed. Mm. Right. And how do we align into a global strategy that could actually have impact for our artists? That was kind of number one. And then how do we have the data do the talking and the deciding on these things? Because that needs to be informing our decisions from the programming of the playlists to the creation or the marketing of the playlists, to, you know, making the decision of we shouldn't put any energy into this because it's just not streaming or people aren't finding it. So understanding sort of those pieces around the playlist, right, the network of playlists that existed is just, right, is how is this going to facilitate our artists and their music? And then the data, how is this actually performing and listening to that? And then also what's missing, right? And what are the, what do we need additional here? And are there things that we need additional here, or are there things we should stop doing? And that was the piece where, you know, there was some of our, you know, key playlists, aligning those, you know, into, you know, a global strategy, but also making sure that there's artist playlists as well. So that was something, that was an initiative that we took on with all of our label partners, just getting, you know, an artist playlist created for everyone on the label. And getting that going to make sure that, you know, because our artists are best marketers, you know, and sometimes have the best exposure. So making sure that, you know, a greatest hits playlist was created for everyone. But also if you have brand new artists, making sure that you create a playlist and you drive to it so that you're not listening to just one of their songs, but the likelihood of you listening to double that, two songs. Mm-hmm. You know, you're instantly creating an opportunity to connect with the fans and drive more streams. Mm-hmm.
So this is we're talking like mid 2010s era, fast forward to, you know, 2020, 2021, you've mentioned the old adage, playlists are the new radio. That was a very popular, you know, thing.
Very popular back in the day.
So how do you view that statement today? And has the role of playlists evolved in a way that maybe in some ways you did expect or maybe in some ways you didn't expect?
Yeah, it's a good question. Because I think the focus needs to maybe shift from the playlist to the mailing list. Mm. And what I mean by that is capturing the fans, right? And capturing someone that's listened to your song on a playlist, that's maybe added that to their library, and show the intent that they like that song. And then how do you take that action and turn that into actually capturing that fan to then share more music with them, right? And so making sure that there's a larger marketing campaign around a potential playlist placement that is longer term and really deals with, right, creating that relationship directly between the artist and the fan.
We've been very data, rah, rah, yay, right? And so let's play devil's advocate for a second. Do you... Are there places, do you feel like, at least from an artist perspective, where data can be misleading, or maybe data should not be as much part of the process? Have you seen that kind of like hesitation or pushback from an artist perspective? Or maybe even other people on the team, you know, whether it be A&R or what have you. How do you kind of like view that kind of like tug of war between like the whole gut first data thing, I guess is the simple way to ask that.
There's a couple things that come that spring to mind. For example, you'll say, oh, this song is, you know, has a million streams overnight. It's doing really well. And clearly it's a hit. Well, where are the streams coming from? You know, there's the deeper questions you have to ask. Where are the streams coming from? You know, is it just one playlist? You know, is it just one playlist that's driving it? Like, are there any, right? Are there any, you know, what's the source of the stream, I should say? You know, I've had people say, oh, this artist is super popular in Spain. Like, she is killing it in Spain. And it's just like, well, because she's just on that one play, like that's one song is on that one playlist that is in Spain.
Yeah.
That's right where the most of the listeners are based there. And it doesn't mean that you should invest in an ad campaign for Spain, because you have to look at the data, right? You have to look deeper at the data to see what it is. And so, yeah. So Jason and I come back to the point of, right, your question was gut versus data. Mm-hmm. And I think the fans decide. The fans are, right, you can think, oh, this song is amazing, we all love it, it gets released, and it's a dud. And no, right, and the fans ultimately decide whether something, right, whether something lives on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the beautiful part of, you know, or scary, I should say, as well, of what we do, where it's just like, it's still art, and the song still is, right, is king.
Right.
And so if you don't have the song, if you don't have the music, then you can't build a career, and you can't fake the data.
Yeah. So we heard through the grapevine that you're working on a new project called Streaming Story. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So one of the, right, in these conversations with artists and managers or partners, the sentence, what's the story? Well, why do I care? I need a streaming story, right? This would come up time and time again of just like, and so for me, it was, how do we tell the story? What is the story? And creating that story, the emotional pull, why do I care about this artist, is something that I think really needs some focus and really needs some help. And I think there's so many ways that, you know, we can build stories by looking at the streams, and then we can also, you know, build the streams by telling a great story. And so creating a venue to do that and tell the stories of artists, but also help them craft that and use all of the data and all of the insights that we do have as an industry to build that and put it together in a package that can really help artists, help managers, help the industry, as a community, tell our stories, through song, but also right through all of the resources we have and all the streaming information that we have at this point in 2021.
So speaking of artists, and this is a big question, but if you could give an independent artist suggestions for how to approach their own playlists, streaming, audience growth strategies, what would they be?
Yeah, so I think I have a few on this. One comes back to that we haven't touched upon much, but thinking about seasonality, right? So, and thinking just a bit more commercially about the music, and thinking about what you release when, right? So write and release a Christmas song, because what listening is happening in the month of December in most places in the world is Christmas music. What's being featured is Christmas music. And so to not, I say December, it's, you know, it's the last quarter of the year, to be honest, but just looking at, you know, what you can do to build, right, to build your fans and your streams and your story during that time, like release a Christmas song. It doesn't have to be original. You can do a cover. So I think, you know, thinking about that, thinking about like what else is happening in these moments to be able to write with an angle to market your music. Like, you know, in January, people are like workout playlists, you know, are where it's at. So people are looking for new music and new songs to program in there. You know, create your own workout playlist. You know, I think there was, you know, there's a few artists that we've created workout playlists for that have done extremely well. But then also think about like, you know, what does summer look like? But also what is, you know, June, you know, like what does Pride look like for you? And what is, you know, Black Music Month look like? So thinking about all these opportunities with a commercial lens a bit to be able to market yourselves and also see that, you know, this is what some of these platforms are looking for during those times. So I would say that that's one thing. And then also thinking about, right, if you get a great, like, don't squander an opportunity. If you have a great playlist placement, use that to convert your fans. So again, take the playlist placement, you know, and convert those fans, right, to a follow, to, you know, saving that song, and, you know, and look at that data and execute one or two things based on what you're seeing in response to your music, in response to your song. And then I think the third thing is, you know, just is really looking across, like just looking holistically at your plan and making sure that there is, right, the music is there, one, but also like what story are you telling with your music, and what story can you tell, like what are your talking points for, you know, that week or that month, right? Where it's just like, you're able to look across all these streaming partners and say, you know what, I have a million streams, you know, I'm top, you know, 100 in these markets. And so under, like, looking at the data more holistically to be able to come up with some of those points that are really headlines, again, driving back to what your story is as an artist.
Awesome. I think that's a fantastic way to end it, unless you have anything else, Jason.
No, I'm good.
Cool. So thanks so much for chatting with us today, Aileen. Is there a way for people to contact you if they want to get in touch, or totally fine if you don't want anybody to contact you?
No, yeah, of course they can get in touch. It's aileen@thestreamingstory.com.
Perfect.
Check it out. Shall we direct people towards streamingstory.com?
Yep, that'd be great.
Awesome. Cool. Link to it definitely in the show notes. But thanks for making time for us today. Aileen, it's been awesome having a show.
It's great talking to you both.
Cool. Thank we'll definitely you. Get drinks sometime soon.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
All right. Bye, guys.
How Music Charts is written and produced by Jason Hoven and Rutger Rosenborg of Chartmetric. As part of our effort to equip artists with the power of music analytics, we've just rolled out a new artist tier, which you can sign up for at app.chartmetric.com/plan/artist for about the price of a coffee per week. Free Chartmetric accounts are available at chartmetric.com, and podcast notes are at blog.chartmetric.com. You can also subscribe there for additional insights delivered to your inbox right after we publish. Did we mention we have a YouTube channel? That's right, subscribe for Chartmetric tutorials and tips for indie artists. Follow our thoughts on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, all at Chartmetric. That's Chartmetric, no S. That's it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.